Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. A lot of things to talk about today, including a big Supreme Court decision yesterday, which we may not actually get to because there are so many other things in the news. In fact, on Earth 2.0, one of the things that we would that would be dominating the news cycle is that there appears to be a shooting war on the border of India and China. And yet it almost isn't registering. So we have a lot of other things I want to talk about. So we are joined by one of our regular guests, I think has probably appeared more on the Bulwark Podcast than any other individual, David Priest from Lawfare, the Chief Operating Officer of Lawfare, who joins us once again. Hey, it's been a while, David. Thanks for coming back.
It has been a while. It either seems like a day or two, or it seems like forever with the events that have gone on since. But good to be back.
Everything feels like forever. I mean, the time-space continuum has been broken. And one of the measures of that, if you go back, and I have this little thing, I sort of keep a kind of a record of things that I do, and every once in a while it will say, hey, do you remember what you did 2 years ago or 1 year ago? And, you know, that's fine. It's the 3 months ago that blows my mind. Because 3 months ago, in many ways, was a completely different world, and yet it's only 3 months. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that 3 months ago Joe Biden was dead in the water. It was going to be Bernie Sanders and everything. And so 3 months ago, you know what I did today? My wife and I got in the car, and we drove to Iowa to pick up our new puppy, Eli. 3 months ago today, but that was also, yeah, I know, and he's ginormous. He's grown, I think he must be at least 60 pounds now. He's got probably another 70 to go. But I was also thinking that was before all the shutdowns. So that may have been like 2 or 3 days before America shut down. So that 3 months ago was like, well, that was the different pre-coronavirus universe.
Well, just think about the timing of that. If the timing had been a week later, You might have one fewer dog in the house right now, and that would be unacceptable.
We have discussed this. Okay, so I want to start by talking about John Bolton, who I have seriously mixed feelings about John Bolton. Somebody asked me, are you going to buy John Bolton's book? And I said, absolutely not. I'm probably going to wait, you know, for the Sparks Notes to read it, but I'm not going to give the guy money because I'm still just, look, he had an opportunity to testify. It's more and more evident that he had a lot to say. And yet he did not do that. But I have to also say that he's clearly triggered President Trump and Bill Barr. So this is what you probably heard this already, David, but this is what the president had to say yesterday.
I'll say if he's doing a book, I think it's totally inappropriate that he does a book. I think I gave him a break. He couldn't get Senate confirmed. He was never Senate confirmed the first time. I don't think he's supposed to even be calling himself an ambassador. Because he couldn't get Senate confirmed. He got in through a little trick, and he was there for a fairly short period of time. I put him here because he couldn't get Senate confirmed. This was a non-Senate confirmed position, as you know.
I think you mentioned that.
He stayed for a short while, and I felt that it was not appropriate that he stay any longer. I wasn't impressed. And somebody said he went out and wrote a book. If he wrote a book, I can't imagine that he can, because that's highly classified information. Ooh. Even conversations with me, they're highly classified. I told that to the Attorney General before. I will consider every conversation with me as president highly classified. So that would mean that if he wrote a book, and if the book gets out, he's broken the law. And I would think that he would have criminal problems. I hope so. Otherwise, I mean, they put a sailor in jail because he sent a photograph of his bed at an engine of an old submarine.
Okay. So there's the president saying that all the conversations with him are highly classified. And if that book gets out, I would think he would have criminal problems. I hope so. So here's the president of the United States threatening John Bolton for publishing a book. David Priest.
Yeah, you got a couple of interesting ironies there. First of all, he started that monologue there by talking about how Bolton only got to be ambassador of the UN through some little trick, and he really wasn't ambassador anyway. Really? This president wants to start going down the road of how acting officials are getting in through little tricks? That's a door you probably don't want to open. But claiming that every conversation is classified, first of all, it's just patently wrong. And we get sick of saying this about things he tweets or says, but it's just plain wrong. But also, it raises the fact, if every conversation you have is classified, and why are you having private conversations with the Russian ambassador and not allowing note takers and things like that? It opens up more questions than it answers. Now, there is a legitimate point here, which is, if Bolton wrote a book and he had a pre-publication agreement with the United States government, he is required to send it in for classification review to make sure that he is not inadvertently putting in something that is classified. And I know this as an author who had to submit a book mm-hmm. to that process, and thousands of others have. It is a frustrating process. It can be a long process in some cases, not mine, but in some cases, authors end up suing the organization that's reviewing the book because of either a way too long process or they're cutting things that are objectively not classified. But in this case, John Bolton says he submitted the manuscript and he hasn't gotten a response he wanted, so he's publishing it anyway. That doesn't make it okay to publish. He has mm-hmm. to agree to the terms of his pre-publication agreement, even though the government holds all the cards. If he has a problem with that, then he should hire an attorney and sue the government to review the manuscript and release it in a timely fashion. Just taking it out there and publishing it isn't the right answer.
But I think, but by the president lashing out at him in the way that he did, it will have the, it actually promotes the book. It will
absolutely.
Mean, you know, I mean, that's the interesting thing about it. He's, I understand why Trump would want to discredit the book, because that's what he does with anyone who criticizes him. But in this particular case, he's sort of implying that, wow, you really don't want to look at this because, I mean, there's, you know, there's naked pictures in there, and like, you don't want to look there. And, you know, so I think it's going to boost the sales of the book. But the other problem is that in the modern day and age, there's no way now to suppress this book. Apparently it's been published, it's out there, he's already given interviews, he's free to go in front of Congress and basically read from his manuscript. So we're going to find out what John Bolton had to say, we know, sooner or later.
And you're right, we don't have to buy it to do that. The fact is, if it in fact is printed and in warehouses, that means almost certainly that some advanced review copies have gone out to, at a minimum, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Washington Times, the New York Post, yeah. the Wall Street Journal. So there will be reviews forthcoming. So we will know the most salacious parts of it. I hear a lot of people saying, well, I'm not going to buy it, but I'm sure, yeah. I'm sure as hell going to check it out from my local library so I can read it. Well, the problem is, libraries buy books. So you think that you're not buying it and putting money in John Bolton's hands, but a significant amount of many nonfiction books revenue comes from library sales, right. because of the tens of thousands of libraries that feel compelled to buy a book of importance.
As an author, thank God about this. But yeah. but also I think that, you know, I was not only not going to buy it, but who cares? It was at the point where, you know, who cares what John Bolton has to say? But when the president says the kinds of things that he's saying, it's like, hey, it's like banned in Boston. You really want to read this? You saw the column earlier this week from George Conway, who said that Bolton made a tragic mistake, not the one you think, though. And I thought he made an interesting point. He said, you know, imagine the book that Bolton could have. You know what that is? This is my HP printer telling me that the cartridge is low, which I know, and I'm trying to ignore. But HP keeps like, you know, hey, you need to buy my, you know, our freaking cartridge again. Just, you know, shut up. Anyway. The book that Bolton could have written if he'd in fact testified, I mean, it would have been like John Dean's Blind Ambition. So he asked the question, why didn't he come forward? And he says, you know, it's not because he was afraid of Trump, because he obviously isn't at the moment. It's not even because of legal consequences, because he's obviously taking a big risk. At one point he was actually practically begging to be forced to testify. So Conway makes an interesting point that his fateful misjudgment was that he overestimated the character, honor, and patriotism of Senate Republicans. He thought that they would compel him to testify. It would have taken just four of them joining with the Democrats for the Senate to have issued this subpoena, but actually only two of them, you know, did that. So
I don't know what's in John Bolton's mind. I can't see past the mustache to try to even get a look inside of his head. But to me, that's plausible. It is also plausible that once he learned that there was not going to be a vote to compel him to testify, he could have easily then said, well, I volunteer to testify regardless. Now, the vote still could have said, we're not going to call you, even though you have volunteered freely. But you can do testimony in two ways. You could do testimony by being called in and being, you know, sitting in the chamber or being deposed. Or you could give an interview and say, look, here's what I'm going to say. Now, there's more jeopardy there, but he certainly could have done it or communicated in a different way. But I think George is fundamentally right, which is Bolton appeared to be making his public proffer, saying, I got some things to say, willing to testify, just call me. And then they didn't call him. Shame on the people who, just like John Bolton, shame on the senators who weren't even willing to listen to him on something that was relevant to the issue at hand.
So before we get into some other things in terms of the politics of the day, including some of the polling, I just wanted to highlight something I mentioned at the top of the program, the fact that there's a shooting war going on the border between India and China that nobody's paying attention to at all. I mean, it's not like these are major countries or anything with massive populations. So what is going on there?
Well, you've got the two most populated countries in the world, and both of them with extensive nuclear weapons, and both of which are trying to carve out regional space. That is, both of them are rising powers, and they've had a clash for a long time. Now, this is the first time since, I think, 1975, if I'm right, that Indian soldiers have died due to clashes, usually up in the higher elevations of the Himalayas in the contested areas. But they're not de-escalating this. That is, this has been going on in a slow-rolling increase for weeks. And China probably sees it as a way of pushing back on India, which has tried to seek closer relations with the United States. India sees it as a chance to stand up to China and say, look, demographics show we are going to be the most populous country in the world coming up very soon. And our economy has been growing pretty well too. So we are not going to basically let you bully us anymore. That's all regular international relations stuff. That's what powers do in conflict with each other. But the issue here now is the United States is not playing the usual role it would, if not as mediator, at least as someone going to both countries and saying, you know what, there are better ways of doing this. Let's not go there. I have no confidence that the government of the United States is playing any constructive role here.
Yeah, speaking of our foreign policy, so I don't pretend to understand what goes on inside the minds of the North Korean leaders, but they blew up a building along the border where they usually negotiate with the South Koreans. So apparently they wanted to underline in rather dramatic fashion the fact that we're no longer engaged in talks with the South Koreans, so we're going to blow up our own building where we would normally sit around and talk. What do you make of that?
Well, this is part of this has been a drumbeat that has been growing for weeks now from the North Koreans. They accused the South Koreans of sending pamphlets over the border, trying to propagandize in North Korea, which South Korean groups have done repeatedly over the decades. But now they've said that the liaison office on that North Korean border town was demolished. What a strong signal that they don't really think that the discussions that had been increasing with the South Koreans over the last few years will be progressing anymore. Now, is this a sign of a Korean War about to begin? Probably not. We don't see that kind of preparation, but we certainly don't see what the president promised us a couple of years ago. We don't see the denuclearization of North Korea. We don't see them building resorts on beautiful beaches because they want to be part of the Western world and the capitalist economy. We see a retrenchment. And what we don't really know is how much of that is due to Kim himself or how much of that is due to the North Korean old guard traditionally saying, we have not received any benefits from these attempts at outreach we've done up to and including meeting with the President of the United States. So let's go back to our old tried and true strategy of just rattling our saber, poking the South Koreans, and then eventually somebody pays us off with an aid package or lets us build a nuclear weapon, and we can just keep doing what we've been doing.
Yeah, you know, it's I'm so disappointed about the lack of resorts in North Korea, because I was really thinking of, you know, putting a deposit down for a timeshare.
It would have been a good summer vacation.
So yeah, I also suppose that the Nobel Prize for Trump is probably, what, a no-go? Just not really going to be happening.
It's looking less likely. I'll say it's gone from 0.01% to half that. Now, the overall picture here, Charlie, though, is we just talked about two momentous things, which is North Korean, South Korean tensions heating up with nuclear weapons playing, and India and China. And I tell you, it wasn't even in my headlines of the sources I see. Everything else is about all the other issues that we continue to deal with. I think that says a lot, and it's a preview of the campaign in a way, because foreign policy is rarely the major issue in a presidential campaign. It has played a role here and there, but primarily people are voting on other issues, and they don't care as much about major foreign policy issues. But if there is a major problem, if India and China actually go to a war in October of this year, or if North Korea invades South Korea, then people will be looking at the election, not merely for all of the things they're looking at, the fitness of Donald Trump to be president, number one, perhaps different policies domestically, but they will also be putting on that commander-in-chief judgment hat and saying, who do we want controlling the United States government and the executive branch if, in fact, we are moving towards some kind of world conflict? And that could be a variable that just isn't showing up in the polls yet.
No, I think you're right. Although I also think that I'm not the only person who is just dreading the next 150 days. That I did, the next 150 days will make us dumber, meaner, and a variety of other things. It's going to be a mess. You know, I've been thinking a lot about the historical parallels, and I know a lot of people have been, you know, saying that Donald Trump wants us to be 1968 all over again. I think they're wrong about that. I mean, Donald Trump wants us to be 1972 all over again. And when Richard Nixon was able to run for re-election despite lots of protests, despite the violence at Kent State. So people need to keep that in mind. But also in 1972, you had a sense that Richard Nixon had a view of the world that was controversial, but it was constructive. I mean, remember, that was the year that he played the China card. And so in terms of being a commander in chief, there are a lot of flaws with Richard Nixon, but Donald Trump is not Richard Nixon in terms of his command of the world stage, the influence on the world stage, the sense that there is a plan and that we're moving in a certain direction. Right now, it's the withdrawal and the spread of chaos.
Yeah, I'm going to go a different direction with this, Charlie, but I'll pick up on your Nixon theme. I think there's more, and maybe it's not a conscious thing, but in a sense, there's more of a desire to be Richard Nixon in 1960 and lose the election. And this picks up on the idea that JVL made in his newsletter yesterday. So listeners, if you're not subscribed to JVL's newsletter from The Bulwark, do it. He made the point that the Republican Party looks less and less like a vote maximizing organism.
Yes.
And it's starting to look more and more like a therapy group where people are less interested in winning elections than in their own feelings and being validated for being outsiders and getting that emotional resonance of grievance. And I got to say, this goes back to some theories about 2016. Donald Trump was not seeking really to be president. He was seeking to run for president, to lose in a close contested election, and then to be the, you know, grievance in chief officer of the United States, where he could be on Twitter, maybe start Trump TV, make a lot of money by building on people's sense that here the Clintons have screwed us again. And that didn't work out because he actually became president. Maybe he wanted to be called president, but I think he's shown in the last 3 years he really doesn't want to do the job of president. So what in 2020? Well, picking up on JVL's theme, I'm not sure the goal is to run a 68 campaign or a 72 campaign. I think he'd be perfectly happy with a 1960 campaign of getting a close enough election, even if losing, that he could complain about. He could say, I must remain in power, saying, I'm going to take this to the Supreme Court, all of these things just to make a mess of it and to build on those feelings of grievance, of being taken advantage of by the system. That's been his theme for years, and I don't see any reason that would change now.
You know, yeah, let me expand on that, because I think there's more than a little truth there. I mean, look, I mean, obviously Donald Trump wants another 4 years as president, but there is a downside to winning, which is then you have to govern. And this piece that you're referring to by Jonathan Last is, you know, talking about, well, what if your movement is reduced to performative emoting and the exercise of feelings? If your feelings are the payoff, then you don't need to win elections. I'm going to read what he writes here. In fact, he said, I'd go a step further. For a political movement focused on the cathartic airing of grievances, losing elections is actually better than winning. Bear with us here. Winning means that you have to spend the next cycle working, making compromises, and defending your achievements or lack thereof. But losing only amplifies the emotional resonance of being aggrieved. It confirms your sense the world is against you and that the other is out to get you. It confers the delicious righteousness of martyrdom. It lets you go on permanent offense. For people who view the world through the lens of grievance, hashtag losing is the real hashtag winning. And that's where the Republican Party is these days, both at the elite and the grassroots levels. And it's not clear to me how they will get out of it. Well, I will tell you that if you follow Trump world and the grievances of Trump world, I think he's onto something there.
Yeah, there definitely is something there. And
so for people who think so for people though, the downside of that, for people who think that Trump's defeat marks the end of Trumpism, don't understand that dynamic. It's why it's going to persist. It's going to be a chronic problem for a long time.
No, in fact, Trumpism is stronger in defeat, because we've seen Trumpism in power. And that's exactly right. The governance side is hard. Listen, running things can be hard. Governing can be hard. And I think it's a lot harder in the federal government than in private industry. And the president has seen that. It's a bit of an exaggeration to say that in the last few years, the only successes of the Trump administration have been court picks and deregulation. But it's not that much of an exaggeration. The rest of governing has been exceptionally hard for this administration, even more so than for most administrations. Losing is easier, and losing, in effect, allows Trumpism to gain strength, whereas governing has exposed the fact that it has its limits. You don't have that same exposure of limits when you're on the outside just complaining about things.
Right. And of course, Trump will never lose. He will only be betrayed and cheated. So he can handle losing the presidency without being a quote unquote loser. By the way, we have to throw this in, watching the reaction on some folks on the right, social conservatives, to the Supreme Court ruling on gay rights, the anger about Neil Gorsuch being the author of that opinion. It was a 6-3 ruling, which is really, you just sense among social conservatives, you know, the sense of betrayal. But also understand the dynamic here, because this issue of appointing Supreme Court justice is central. This is how they have rationalized all of their compromises, all the looking the other way, all of the, you know, porn, paying off porn stars, kids in cages. It doesn't matter because but Gorsuch. So this is a real interesting moment to watch the way they are reacting. Now, will it actually have any consequences? I don't know. But this is one of those moments where the anger and disappointment and sense of betrayal among Trump's core constituency is really intense over the last 24 hours. Whether it will last, I don't know.
Yeah, it's understandable, because the idea here is that you had an independent judiciary, but conservative leaning, such that taking cases on their merits would lead to the desired outcome. But when you have a conservative judge who looks at something and actually interprets it different than you would and gives you a different policy outcome, you've got a real problem there. Because do you stick with your supposed philosophy of judicial independence and ability to interpret things? Or do you say, we just want somebody who is going to be a rubber stamp for the policies we want? And here was a divergence on that, is whether you agree with the legal justifications for the judgment or not. Gorsuch and others came out and said, we look at it this way. The irony is that if in fact Hillary Clinton had won the election in 2016 and this case had come up and she had appointed judges instead, mm-hmm. it probably would have also been 6-3. It certainly the outcome would not have changed even if one of the votes were slightly different. So you can understand the angst of the social conservatives on this issue. But you also have to realize that things change. I was not alive at the time of some of the rulings in the 50s and into the 60s when some things may have felt similar of we're moving too fast. How can you be using that law in order to apply this? And yet history does move forward. And it's hard to reconcile that in so many ways. That's a subject for another podcast. But to me, it's not going to lead to people abandoning Trump because I don't think the reaction to this is, well, why did we bother to invest in Trump despite all of his negatives if we didn't get the outcome we wanted in the Supreme Court? That logic doesn't make you support somebody who is even less likely to give you what you want in the Supreme Court.
It might lead some of these voters to sit home, though, because also as we were talking about that sense of grievance and victimization, there's also a deep strain of, you know, I can't trust anyone. They will all betray me. And if that is projected onto Trump, that might actually have some consequence. Okay, so let's shift to where we're at in this race. Sure. There's a lot of polling out there. And, you know, the polling would suggest that Joe Biden has a pretty strong national lead. The swing state polls, which are the only things that matter, are a somewhat different matter, but just this morning, big poll out of Michigan showing Biden ahead by 12 points in a state that was won by Trump 4 years ago. So give me your sense, David, of what you are seeing in the polls and how we should be reading them.
Yeah, and I think I saw another poll that said Biden had a 16-point lead in Michigan, which is...
Okay, I'm sorry, that was the one I was referring
striking
to.
Striking, when you think about it. As I recall, in 2016... both Michigan and Wisconsin were, under 1% for Trump winning. And now both of them show that there's a pretty dramatic lead, certainly well above the margin of error for Vice President Biden going forward. If you look at the moving averages, that's more interesting than one particular poll. And in Michigan, they've been pretty steady now since the beginning of May. I think they've been averaging something like 7 or 8%. And of course, that average will go up with these new polls. Wisconsin has been averaging something like 6% up for Biden. Florida and Arizona have been going Biden for 2, 3, 4%. You're starting to get into game over territory if you've got those locked in. And of course, then you get the interesting results out of places like Iowa, Georgia, Texas, that are showing that it's in some cases within the margin of error, which is just stunning. But this is exactly what we should be talking about, Charlie, is these states, because the headlines overall tend to be the national polls. National polls don't matter. If you get the right coalition of states, you can lose the popular vote by a dramatic margin and still get the electoral votes. So it's worthwhile to focus on Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina. These are the states where it really matters. Now, the problem is we're in June, and June is a long way away from the election. I know you're old enough to remember this, and many listeners are also old enough to remember this, but it seemed to me that Michael Dukakis, back in 1988...
I remember this very well.
Something. I think it was in June, but I may be off by a few weeks.
July.
But at one point, he had 55% in a national poll, and Bush had 38%. I mean, a 17-point national lead.
I think it was between the conventions. At least that's my memory. It was 17 points. So the race felt like it was over in July. Yeah. And we know that turned around.
Yeah. So there are two consequences of this. One is... yeah, we're still, 150 days or so from the election, and a lot of variables can come up, whether it's some international crisis, whether it's not just a second wave, because we haven't left the first wave of COVID-19, but exactly how the response goes to the plateauing and in some states the increase of deaths into this virus. Whatever the variables are, It could be Trump's health. It could be Biden's health. It could be a vice presidential pick that's controversial, something that could possibly move those numbers. That's one category. But the other thing is the motivation factor. And I think this is partially what affected Dukakis in 88. You have a 17-point lead, and you have perceptions of the economy being really bad, which they were in the summer of 88. Now, by fall of 88, before the election, the economic numbers were actually going up. But perceptions were that the economy was still bad, and that matters much more than reality for voters. You've got a lot of time between now and November. But Dukakis, the campaign, I wouldn't say they got cocky, but they lost some of that edge in the summer and fall, thinking, oh, we can just ride this out. If the Biden campaign does the same thing, they're in trouble. I've seen many people comment, you have to run this campaign as if you're losing by one vote in every state on every day, and run hard and keep pushing. You can't take these leads, even in states like Michigan and Wisconsin, for granted, or you're going to lose in November.
No, and I think that's good advice to any campaign. You know, I'm thinking back to 1988, and I do remember that. I remember that summer actually pretty well. But you know what I remember about 1988? The level of passion was nowhere near to what we have now. It was kind of a hangover election. Nobody was that excited about George H.W. Bush after two terms of Reagan. Nobody was that excited about Michael Dukakis. Remember, he was running as, can we just have a boring, competent guy? And so he wasn't defined. He wasn't particularly well known. George H.W. Bush did not have the cult of personality. So you didn't have the level of engagement in politics. There was not a sense in 1988 that the fate of the country was in the balance. I wonder whether the numbers are just more immovable now than then because the engagement. But you're right. You have to focus on each one of these votes. By the way, in terms of the swing state votes, can we talk about Iowa for a second? Because I find that to be very interesting. This is the Des Moines Register poll, which is actually a very highly respected poll. And I think it's worthwhile looking at the polls that have the best track record. They had Joni Ernst down by 3 points, the Republican incumbent, which is stunning because if Joni Ernst loses, the Republicans can kiss their majority in the Senate goodbye. So then people were waiting, well, what are the Trump numbers? Trump is up by one, which some people were surprised. How can Joni Ernst be down by three and Trump still up by one? But that's all within the margin of error. And this is a state that Trump won by more than 9 points. So I think the smart analysis is that if Trump is only up by 1 point in a state like Iowa, then he's really in trouble. And this does reflect the weakness in a lot of these swing states. But what I've been telling people who've asked me about Wisconsin is I think Wisconsin is going to be very, very tough. I think it's going to be very, very close. And I also think that there's a real chance that the left will, and they've done this in the past, overplay their hand. And I'm really struck by, the shift in opinion on Black Lives Matter is very real. It's very dramatic. It's a total game changer. Trump, I think, is overestimating the potential for a backlash. But don't count it out, because right now, among a lot of conservatives, a lot of suburbanites in Wisconsin, they're looking at what's going on in Seattle, and they're wondering, is there going to be riots? Is there going to be violence? So far, I think Joe Biden has handled this extremely well. And yet I see that there are 50 liberal groups, I'm not going to throw it around, who've written a letter saying that Joe Biden's support for additional money for community policing is a slap in the face to the Black community because he is not embracing the defund movement. Right. And I'll tell you what my reaction to that was. Are you really intent on snatching defeat from the jaws of victory? Because I think Joe Biden is actually doing a pretty good job in threading the needle right now of public opinion, knowing which voters he needs to not alienate. And the left is going, no, you need to go all the way. Absolutely. You need to take the most extreme position possible. I don't know how that's going to play out, whether the senator will hold.
It hasn't been that difficult of a needle to thread. The poll numbers on Trump and his handling of the protests since George Floyd's killing have been disastrous. He is not getting any kind of law and order bump in the polls because of the protests, or those people who took advantage of the protests to do violence. So Biden is playing a pretty safe road here, and he has very little incentive to give in to the most radical demands of the movement here. In fact, he can stake out a position that years and perhaps even months ago would have been considered fairly radical, and still be in very safe territory with the majority of the American public, who have moved almost as much on this, almost as quickly as they did on the issue of gay marriage. And that says a lot for Biden, but I think it says a lot more about the body politic. And that affects even places like Iowa. I mean, we have to remember, yes, it seems like with Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst in Iowa, that Iowa is a hardcore Republican state. And yes, it has voted Republican much more often in presidential elections. But you remember Tom Harkin. Sure. Tom Harkin was the senator from Iowa from, what, 1985 or so until just a few years ago. And you've got a significant rallying of the Democratic base in Iowa, because look at what happened during this primary season. You had Pete Buttigieg lighting Iowa on fire. You had other candidates spending so much time and money in Iowa that people were getting the messages of the Democratic candidates, and Republicans, you know, obviously they've been discouraging any primary challenge to Trump in many states, and there simply wasn't the same amount of media attention to Republican messages. And that does permeate. Now, there will be people who dig their heels in and resist anything, but they were starting to hear debates over things that they probably hadn't heard much. And they weren't just hearing it on TV. They weren't just hearing it or reading it in the newspapers. They were out there talking to Mayor Pete, because he visited something like, you know, 40 billion different restaurants and cafes and houses in Iowa. That actually may affect things a little bit in Iowa more than we thought, because the amount of time spent there does have an impact, not just within the primaries, but on the overall environment. So it would not surprise me if Ernst is in more trouble than even her internal polls would have showed her a few months ago.
No, I think that is an interesting point. Let's talk about COVID-19 at the moment. Hmm. President said yesterday that, I'm not making this up, if we stop testing right now, we'd have very few cases, if any.
Hmm.
I just, you know, how many times do we have to go over this sort of thing yet? And you know what? If I stop weighing myself, I could eat as much Haagen-Dazs as I wanted
right.
to. If we stopped reporting unemployment numbers, we'd have no unemployment. You know, this guy, it's all about the image. It's all about the top lines.
What I can't separate out, Charlie, is whether he knows better and he's saying it because that's literally about the best spin he has left. He can't run on his policies of the last few months because they've been generally negative on COVID-19 response as judged by the American people in the polling. So does he know that that's crap and he's simply putting it out there because he doesn't have anything better to say? Or does he not understand that? Is he saying that and he actually believes it? Now, at a certain level, it doesn't matter because the effect is still the same. He's still saying it, and he's still showing that the policy is to pretend that this isn't happening as much as possible and hope that we can move past it and he can get an economic bump in the fall going into the election. So it really doesn't matter, but it does speak to the president's decision-making on so many other issues that you have to wonder, is he actually getting and internalizing the information he needs to make decisions, or is he simply ignorant about these matters?
Well, also, maybe it's a reflection of the fact that the American public has just lost interest in this. And we're at this position right now where I think a lot of people in America are going, I don't know who to believe. I don't know who to trust anymore. I don't know, you know, if the coronavirus does come back virulently, I think it's very clear that the administration is not going to lead on this, that we are not going to shut things down. And I will tell you that there's a lot of cognitive dissonance. So I'm looking at a picture. I'm looking at a story actually from National Review, a conservative publication. But I do think it's worthwhile understanding how a lot of Americans are looking at this. So in New York City, which is run by one of the worst mayors in America, Bill de Blasio, the authorities decided to weld the gates of a playground in Brooklyn shut. This is a playground that is frequented by Orthodox Jews. They decided they were going to weld it shut. One day after this massive protest in Brooklyn, Black Lives Matter protest. So, and the Jews in New York City, of course, are they're not having it. In fact, they just cut the lock that the New York mayor put on their park. But I guess people looking at this going, the hypocrisy here. How can you object? It's like side by side, people talking about the president's rally in Tulsa, which I think is going to be a real danger to public health, especially given the numbers in Oklahoma and the fact that nobody in that rally is going to be wearing a mask, right? Because it's Trump world. So that's a danger. Side by side with these massive other protests, and people are saying, well, what? How can you be worried about this when you are applauding that? And the reason I'm bringing this up is because this perception is driving behavior, and it is driving the skepticism about taking the coronavirus more seriously.
It's hard for people to do, and it's hard for me too. I'm not accusing other people of this. I think it's a human psychology thing. It's hard to be intellectually honest about this. It really is, because on the one hand, you understand what the science is saying, and science is emerging on this. This is not a known quantity, and we're learning more as time goes on about how the droplets are passed, about whether masks matter, about whether social distancing matters, and if so, how much. But we're not good at hearing all of the information saying you are best off staying isolated, you're best off wearing a mask, you shouldn't be around other people. And then you see images of tens of thousands of people in proximity to each other, many of them without masks, and nobody's falling over and dying. Now, yeah. Of course, it may be 2-3 weeks, and we are seeing rising numbers in many places, not just from protests, but numbers are rising from openings before the protest. So yes, in fact, there are going to be people who die because they went to these protests and they were close to each other and somebody spread the virus and they weren't wearing a mask and they got it. That's almost certain that some people will die because of that. But it's not going to be obvious that it was because of that, or it was at a certain time, or it was due to that instead of a pool party somewhere else. This is hard for us to get our hands around.
Yeah,
and it's even harder when many of us still don't have someone close to us who has died from this. Most people I talk to do know people who have tested positive or had some symptoms but got through it. But at this point, even though we're approaching 120,000 US deaths, it has still not touched every family in America. So what do they see? They see that they're having trouble paying their bills. They see that the person next door who runs a restaurant has had to close it and has no prospects for reopening it. They see that they are still on unemployment when they think they should be back at their job. And then they see a bunch of people in cities walking around, marching and protesting, seemingly not caring about this. Now, I understand that. You can get back at that by saying, well, a lot of the protesters, if you look at it, a lot of them were wearing masks. And right, it turns out the masks are really effective for stopping the spread of it from going out from one person to another person. But that's not what people are seeing. People are seeing just the masses of people out there. Yeah. How does that translate to a political rally? Honestly, I have a hard time telling people in Tulsa who want to go to a political rally for the president, it's good for people in cities to go out and protest something, and that's okay. But you shouldn't go to a rally for something you support. Now,
yeah.
I wish they would wear masks for their own sake and for the sake of others. I really wish they would. But I have a hard time saying to them with a straight face, no, you need to stay home because of those conditions. But those people were justified in going out for their conditions.
Now we're going to get blowback for this, but this is just the reality that you can't really have that double to basically say, well, their cause is more important than your cause. Their First Amendment rights are more important than your First Amendment rights. But again, let's pull back for a little bit. I know that we've talked about this for months, but this is a time when a national crisis should have had a unifying effect, and instead it became this source of worse division in the country because of the political tribal loyalty is dictating how people react to the dangers of the virus. And this is getting worse, not better. And everybody has now their narrative. If it comes roaring back in the fall, the right will say it's because of these rallies. The left will say it's because of the failures of Donald Trump. There's going to be truth on both of them. But the problem is that the American public, grandma, is going to be the collateral damage because we are so torn apart here. And, you know, not everything is Donald Trump's fault, but he does set the tone. And his absolute abdication of leadership going forward, let's leave aside all the bungles and all the misinformation in the past, his complete abdication means that we are not going to be able to respond to this going forward. And again, there was once this idea that what would it take to pull us together? Well, some sort of a major national disaster. But we're now seeing that no, yeah. even in the face of this, even if it's 150,000 dead Americans, this is not pulling us together. We are not one country.
What I would love to see, and I'm afraid it's not constitutionally in his character, but honestly, I would love to see the president come out tomorrow and say, look, you know, he doesn't have to say he was wrong because those words probably won't come out of his mouth. But look, you know, I've thought about this again, and I think everyone should be wearing a mask. It's what the Centers for Disease Control, it's what the U.S. government is officially recommending. And, you know, this is not a political issue. If you wear a mask, you're not taking a political side. You're taking the side of life. And if we truly support life like we say we do, put on a mask, yeah. Save, if not your grandmother, save somebody else's grandmother, maybe save yourself, maybe save your kids, because kids are dying too. So put on a mask and leave politics out of it. Now,
well, as we all
that
know
would that. Actually give him a bump in the polls. That honestly, that could make yeah. the election more close. That could have all kinds of effects. But I would wish all of that if he would just get out there and say, let's do something that's in the interest of all Americans' lives instead of trying to hype up this partisan conflict.
And I'm laughing about this because you're right. This would be in his political interest to say this, but it is absolutely not possible that, in fact, he will do it. Mm. Speaking of the president, of course, the latest development is the Food and Drug Administration has revoked the emergency use authorization for his favorite drug, the about hydroxychloroquine.
Yep.
Which, of course, was touted by the president over and over and over again, touted by Fox News. And they're basically saying, yeah, it doesn't work. And that's almost like a footnote here, that the president of the United States used his bully pulpit at a crucial moment to basically peddle snake oil.
Mm.
And it's, so they're...
It's, when people it's a shame that it's taken this long for it to work, but the one thing is that they want to get it right, and if they issue guidance and then they have to revise it 2 weeks later and revise it 2 weeks later. But this seems pretty definitive. In this case, the president was wrong. The indications are that he should have known it was wrong, and he had people probably telling him it was wrong, and yet he did something that affected people's livelihood. That's not acceptable. And for all the other things we've looked at, for all the other things we've talked about, the president peddling snake oil would be preferable to the president peddling a dangerous drug that certainly harmed people and may have killed people who thought that they should take it because, well, if the president's allowed to take it, it must be okay. That is simply unacceptable.
So we're out of time, but at some point we have to have a conversation about police unions and qualified immunity. Because it is fascinating to me how on the right there has been a consensus about the negative effects of public employee unions, with the exception of police unions, which are clearly part of this problem. And I was amazed at Senator Rick Scott, who I think is a normally pretty reasonable guy, and he's leading the Republican effort in the Senate to come up with some sort of police reform bill, saying that just describing reform of qualified immunity, which basically means the immunization from accountability of many police officers who've engaged in bad behavior, that was a poison pill. I don't understand that, because I would think that from a conservative point of view, people ought to understand that the idea of giving the state, you know, immunity from accountability is a bad idea. But they're dug in on this. They're dug in on support for police unions, and they're dug in on support of a really bad legal doctrine.
It is contrary to the philosophy in both of those ways, both the union philosophy and the government accountability. I'll point I'll point to a really fascinating conversation I just had on the Lawfare podcast with Patrick Skinner, who's getting a lot of attention. He's a police officer in Savannah, Georgia, but he's been out there tweeting now for a couple of years since he started about what he learned as a CIA officer, because he was a case officer at the CIA when I was there, and what he learned in Afghanistan and Iraq about how to actually win hearts and minds and how poorly we were doing it in many cases. And yet we're militarizing the police in the United States, and we're talking about a warrior mentality and fearing the worst with every encounter with a, quote, civilian. He said, why are we even thinking that way? We are our neighbors. I am literally neighbors with the people that I'm a police officer for. I work for them. My job is not to put my boot down on them. My job is not to fear death every time I interact with them. My job is to serve them. And it was a great conversation showing that some of the hard-learned lessons we have in national security, he's applying to literally walking the streets in a dangerous city and defusing situations by actually treating people like people instead of pulling out the highest grade military weapon your police department can get its hands on. Fascinating conversation if you want to hear a thoughtful take on policing.
I would definitely like to listen to that. I mean, what a radical concept to actually serve and protect as opposed to dominate. David Priest, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.